Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right. Welcome to Here District. Marcus Johnson, the captain of this fantastic, can we still say fantastic? I guess it's a fantastic voyage, Chris. The Milwaukee Bucks experience. And always got to start with this. Chris and I are the only father and son duo in the history of college basketball to win a national championship at the same school. We know we've got Sean May, somebody that our guest is familiar with, and Scott May, and some other people, the Bibbies, Henry and Mike. And did Luke and Bill win one? I don't know.
Yeah, they did, but Luke was at Arizona.
Yeah, but they're different schools. Yeah, but I'm just throwing out father and sons. But anyway, so let's move on to our guest for today on the Here District. And man, we are really excited about, especially recently, it's a lot of stuff going on out there on the internet. But Rashad McCants, welcome to Here District, man. Thank you for joining us.
Appreciate y'all having me, man. Congratulations for all the success you guys are having.
Yeah, appreciate you, man. And you know, you guys do a great job. You're a regular cast member on Gil's Arena. How long have you been on Gil's Arena? You weren't there at the start, right? You tell me. How long has it been for you with Gil's Arena?
I'm one of the forefathers. I was there from the beginning, very first one. So yeah, it's season four right now.
So it was you, the same crew, Nick, Brandon, Kenyon, and
it was just me, Brandon, Gil, and Josiah.
Okay. So Kenyon was the one that was kind of brought on.
Nick as well. Nick and Kenyon came on.
Okay, but you guys do a great job, man. And so just a little bit about you. Born and raised in Asheville, North Carolina. You were just a terrific, terrific high school player, number one ranked shooting guard in your class, McDonald's All-American, played in the Mickey D, drafted 14th overall by the Timberwolves in 2005, a national champion at UNC down in Tobacco Road. I had to wear my UCLA shirt just to represent back in 2005. And man, just a great career. And so let's go back to growing up, man, in Asheville. The thing that jumped out with your resume to me, Rashad, is that you left home to go to New Hampshire your last 2 years in high school. What was that about? I mean, you felt like that was a better opportunity? You tell us, what was that about leaving the confines of and comfort of home to go all the way up the coast to New Hampshire to play basketball in high school?
Oh, well, similar to Gladiator, the movie, 300, the movie. In order for a king to be a king, you know, you have to go out and you have to kill for yourself, and you have to learn how to live amongst the wolves. And 15 years old, you know, made a decision to go and really take my life into my own hands and learn what it is like to be on my own. And my father was he was a little bit, you know,
apprehensive
about it, timid about it at first, but once he understood the opportunity to go to a boarding school and for me to put my grades first, I think that was the number one thing, was academics and focusing on getting grades to go to the next level, which we ended up coming to the conclusion that basketball was going to be something that I was going to pursue. So once that became in the forefront of our journey, it was go up there and get your grades right and focus on basketball. And when I was up there, I was a two-time student of the year, a two-time player of the year, and was able to go on to have a 1140, 1120 on my SATs and have the opportunity to go to any college I wanted to.
But why couldn't that happen in Asheville? Could that have happened in Asheville for you? But was that a situation where that you just had to get away, you needed to get away?
Well, Asheville didn't have a competition that was going to be warranted to give me the best chances to showcase my talents. And then the classroom, the teachers were giving us a lot of leeway because of who we are, how good I was. I was a freshman playing varsity. I was co-player of the year my freshman year. It got very easy for me when it came down to both academics and athletics. So I went to a Class A conference in New England where there was Winchendon, Exeter, Worcester Academy, all of the big premier New England schools that have fifth-year seniors. So I really wanted to challenge myself and go up there and dominate, which I did.
So now, and I got some familiarity because I was looking at one of those situations for my youngest son, Sarah, St. Andrews. That's somewhere at Rhode Island, maybe in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. But Michael Carter Williams came out of that program. But what other big time ballers? You mentioned all these great Exeter, Winchendon, all these great prep schools. Any names that came out of there that made it to the NBA that you competed against in high school?
Oh, Caron Butler, Bernard Robertson, Craig Smith, Jared Jack. Oh, so many. Francisco Garcia. There's a lot of guys up there. Ryan Gomes went to St. Thomas More. There was a lot of guys that went through there and wanted to excel on both sides, whether it have an extra year to prove themselves, but also to get their academics together.
Well, where were you in New Hampshire? What town, what city or town were you in?
It was called New Hampton, New Hampshire. And I think any boarding school is going to be a difference of culture depending on where you're from, because every city, every state has a hood. And there's no different from L.A. I know you guys think that your hoods are so different than everyone else's, but
our hoods are nice, brother. Our hoods, we got palm trees.
We got palm trees, bro. Our hoods are straight.
Every hood has its poverty levels and,
for sure,
and gangs and all of that kind of stuff. And New Hampton was a melting pot. It was a welcome inside from international students. I was able to play with a lot of Yugoslavian players, Serbian, California guys who went to Mater Dei, and different places all over the country and all over the world. So it gave me a great sense of multifaceted, multidimensional type of energy, man. It gave me that we can mix and match and dip and have a dormitory full of people who never been together, but also become friends. So I had 2 years of that where it was a culture shock at first because I was bringing my culture to something that was different. So my coach had to adjust me because I was real rough around the edges. You know, I cussed a lot and I sparked off a lot. I used to dunk on guys and lead a gym. And I used to talk my stuff all the time, and it's no different than what I do now, but I was a lot younger. I was a lot quicker on the wick. So I had to dial it back very quickly and understand the opportunity at hand and bring my teammates closer.
For you, what was your daily regimen like that really helped you propel yourself into McDonald's All-American?
Well, I met this guy. His name was Mike Procopio. He worked for the Boston Celtics. He was a film guy. He was Kobe Bryant's film guy. He was Paul Pierce's film guy. He was the greatest aspiration for me in my life. He gave me the tools that pretty much forged me into a great shooting guard. He gave me footage of Paul Pierce and Kobe Bryant, along with Steve Nash, Dirk Nowitzki, Hakeem Olajuwon. And I was able to put a lot of this footwork into my game and being able to go into the gym and study and feel myself doing these things, and then getting into the weight room. That was more important than anything because I wanted to be a total player. I didn't want to be one dimensional. So I always worked on my post game. I was 6'4". I've been 6'4" since I was 13. So I always
played. One of them dudes. Okay. And big and strong. Okay.
So I was playing the center position most of my youth. So I usually play when we were in the first 2 years of my high school years. I was training with the bigs and the guards. So I would get my post work in. I would go and get my ball handling in. So by the time I got to boarding school, I put all that work into this work. And then you hear a bunch of stories of guys telling you about what they did when they were in the NBA and how much harder they worked in the NBA. But I put that work in high school. Yeah. And so I was so far ahead of the curve. By the time I got to UNC, the guys that I was playing with had never seen that this level of efficiency, this level of work ethic. And, you know, I just kind of brought them in and helped them understand getting in the gym was so important.
when you go to an experience like that, where you're the fish out of water, sometimes it forces you to like be introspective and kind of have to fend on your own. And you leave situations like that learning stuff. Was there any one thing that you learned from that situation that you still carry with you today?
Yeah, that winning championships take time. I was there for 2 years. The first year we came up short. The second year we won it all. I figured that it was the team chemistry that was the one thing that was going to be the deciding factor, but it was also going to be leadership. We changed teams completely outside of maybe two or three guys between my junior and senior year. So I figured that my leadership and my consistency and my work ethic was going to be the deciding factor of us winning it all. So the one thing that I could take from it was being a consistent leader and being someone that is willing to accept accountability and willing to put it all on the line and allow the coach to coach you and to buy into the system and be the example was the one thing that I learned in high school that I took to North Carolina as well.
So from what I hear, I mean, you talked about dunking on people and leaving the gym and walking out the gym, dunking on them and primal yell or whatever, I don't know, whatever. It sounds like from your junior year to your senior year, you kind of got that epiphany that you needed to buy in a little more. Is that accurate to say?
Well, it was more of leaving my primal rage from the survival of the hood and proving myself to people from where I grew up into I've already have this position. I don't have to fight for this position and I have to prove nothing to my teammates. So my survival skill set needed to change to leadership skill set. So I was able to early, the coach actually was going to kick me off the team and we had a meeting where it just had to get through to me that look, we don't do this type of stuff. These are your teammates. You can't just go out here screaming at them, dunking on them, walking out of the gym. And it was just me trying to prove to them that I'm like that. And that I'm not one of these other guys. I'm one of the best you ever seen. So once I felt my teammates had that and that my coach understood that my messaging was a little bit different, I was able to hone in on what he wanted from me. And he was able to carve me in and mold me into a leader.
When you found out that you were McDonald's All-American, you're playing in the McD game, was that a surprise to you? Were you elated about that? Or was it just like, hey, this is how it's supposed to shake down?
So as a junior, I was able to go to Nike camp in USA, where I was able to showcase my talent to the best players in the world and the best players in the country. And from there, every summer I was in Nike camp. I was at USA and I became a premier player based on playing against the top talent. So by the time Parade All-American came, McDonald's All-American came, there was no question about whether or not I was in there or not, because I had already dominated. I had already dominated my position. I already showcased that I'm one of the guys. And I was playing in a class of in our league, which is the New England Prep League. Yeah. We were one of the top leagues in the country. Yeah. So it was very difficult to play in that league and not be considered a McDonald's All-American or a Parade All-American.
North Carolina. All right. So now, was that always on the radar? Was that just such a natural fit, like me and UCLA, LA, that there was
no
competition? Or how'd that play out?
No. Actually, North Carolina wasn't recruiting me. They felt that my intensity was a little bit too much.
Who told you that? How did you find that out?
My coach put me in the office because that's where I wanted to go. And he said that they weren't recruiting me. I think we had a game, a double overtime game against James White, Hargrave Academy. And I had a double technical where I dunked and I slapped the glass and I got ejected from the game. Mm. I think I had 40 that game, but we ended up losing. I remember, I think it was Doug Wojcik or Coach Quarterbaum was at the game and they said that they didn't think I was a good fit. I was too intense. And that kind of pissed me off, and I kind of took that personal at that moment. And I had everybody else in the country recruiting me, Duke, Kansas, everybody. Stanford, I was thinking about going to Stanford. I was thinking about going to UCLA. I was very close to actually going to UCLA, which I'm surprised I never took an official visit. I should have took an official visit.
Was that Ben Holland? Was that Ben Holland at the time?
I think that was Lavin. That was Steve.
Okay.
Um, that was when Brian Morrison had came out,
right?
Transferred out here.
Oh yeah.
And it was a close for UConn. I was almost going to go to UConn. Considered going to Duke right before JJ actually committed, but it was really a passionate thing for me to follow greatness. My whole thing was I want to be just as monumental and inspirational as Michael Jordan. And he was somebody that I seen had a hold on all the kids with all the commercials and the admiration. And I remember made my mind up when I was a 13, 14, that I wanted to be just as good as Mike. Yeah. So the having the opportunity to go to North Carolina and following his footsteps, I think it was taken off of the table and I didn't like that. So I did everything in my power to convince them to recruit me. So we ended up winning the Nationals. And once we won the Nationals, Coach Doherty was at the championship game. He seen my leadership. He seen my ferocity. And at the time, I was studying Shane Battier's leadership at Duke around 2001, actually. It was around 2001. And that was the energy that I was giving off to all of my teammates. We ended up winning the championship my senior year, and then we ended up winning Nationals that year. And I ended up getting recruited going into my senior year and being able to basically have that in my bag and not having to worry about going to any other school. And then they had me recruiting guys. So that made it even, you know, that much wholesome, because Michael Jordan, then he embraced me as being a top recruit, and going to go get Sean May to be a part of our team was important. And us having the best recruiting class in that class.
You mentioned Mike, Steph Curry, James Worthy, David Thompson. The state of North Carolina has produced some of the greatest basketball players we've ever seen. Shy, what is it about North Carolina, the state, the area, that makes y'all as ballers so real?
You can't forget, you know, Chris Paul, John Wall, yes, DJ sir. Tucker. Sheesh. There's a lot of guys there.
But Bobby Jones.
Bobby Jones. Man. Daryl Armstrong, man.
Indeed.
These are guys that are, these are guys that are all very passionate about the game of basketball. We take the game of basketball very serious. And I think that what separates us is that we are all very detailed. We're all leadership, quality based. We're all about winning championships, or at least striving for that. Yeah. And I believe that the competitive side of us won't allow us to be anything other than dogs. You look at Jerry Stackhouse, you look at Antoine Jameson, you look at guys like that, that just dogs. Guys that just go after it no matter what. And that's how we prided ourselves, especially representing not only the state, but if you went to Carolina, it was an expectation for you to represent to a certain standard.
Yes, sir.
How old were you when you first dunked?
I was in seventh grade.
Like 12, 13 years old?
Yeah, like 12. I think I was 12.
One of those dudes.
Yeah.
Somebody talked about North Carolina players not averaging 20. Like, they kept Michael Jordan below 20 because they didn't, I don't know, the team concept and all that. But talk about that, man. Was there some friction to be able to do that? Or how did that work out for you that second year, the 20-point per game year?
Well, my freshman year, Matt Gordy was the coach. He got fired my freshman year, and then Coach Williams came in the second and third year. Okay. So the history of North Carolina is no guard at least, has been able to average over 20 points per game under Dean Smith. And Dean Smith had purposely kept Michael Jordan under that just to uphold the team integrity of team over talent.
Right.
You know, keep it all together, play hard, play smart together, all that kind of stuff. So Michael was held back when he was there. Matt Daugherty played with Michael, so he understood what was happening. And I just remember my freshman year, I was averaging about 21 a game, leading the ACC in scoring. And I was getting too much attention for the liking of Matt Daugherty. And I was getting headlines that was Sam McCants in the Tar Heels. I was on TV Guide. I was doing a lot of things I wasn't supposed to be doing. And he didn't like that. So he pulled me in the office one day and told me that I reminded him of Mike and how I come in the locker room. He assumed that my teammates didn't like him, didn't like me, like he and the other teammates didn't like Mike. So he was giving me all these comparisons and saying that this is his team. And if Mike can't average 21, I'm not going to allow you to average 21. So he came up with some type of excuse to bench me for 3 games, which was a defensive thing. And he ended up benching me for 3 games, then bringing my average from 21 to 17.
So he would play you a minimal minutes and then pull you out? Just oh, man, that's a bull. And how did you process that? Was steam coming out of your ears? Or were you able to work your way through it?
It was the first time I cried. It was the first time. And it wasn't like a cry. It was like tears down my cheek right before practice started, because I had no idea what the fuck was going on. Yeah. And I remember also he had tried to send me to a psychologist a few times to try to, because he didn't want to talk to me man to man. So he sent me to a psychologist to try to figure out what was going through my head. And the psychologist literally told me that I was the most brilliant player or person that he had spoken to on campus, and that he had no idea why I was speaking to him and what the problem was. But he was ordered to report back to coach about what they talked about. And my mom called and cussed him out, told him that we were never going to go talk to the psychologist again. It was a whole lot of stuff going on that year that I didn't understand why people were trying to sabotage me being a diaper dandy, a one and done. I had the potential to be all of that, but it was held back. And then it was also blamed on me that he got fired.
Is there any sort of reconciliation with your time or with what Doherty did to you, or basically that part of your North Carolina career? Are you still tripping on that, or have you moved past that?
No, my jersey's in the rafters.
Yes, sir. Okay.
I mean, if anybody, like a lot of people.
Still?
They don't have intelligence. A lot of people are really stupid. Yeah. And when you think about ignorance, you don't go and read the history books. I'm in the ACC history books. I'm in the North Carolina history books. I held records for almost 20 years. And when it comes down to me and what I was doing, I wasn't chasing a coach. I wasn't doing this for a culture or even a school. Yeah. I was chasing Michael Jordan. My jersey's in the rafters next to Michael Jordan's jersey, or right behind it. And I wasn't going to transfer from North Carolina based on my treatment because of the coach. I was going to stand my ground and hold the fort down and do what I came to do, which was win a national championship and put my jersey in the rafters. I could have easily quit. Yeah. I could have easily ran away. I could have easily done what all of my teammates threatened to do to the chancellor. If Coach Doherty wasn't fired, they were all going to transfer. I was the only guy that said that I wasn't going to transfer, that I didn't come here for him. Wow. So all of that stuff was thrown under the rug and I was blamed. But no one knows none of this stuff, right? Because, you know, people don't want to do the research. People don't want to hear the truth. They just want to go with the hot takes and go with the flow.
Was it a lot of dysfunction you guys had to overcome to win that natty? Or just talk about that journey and how y'all got to the natty that year.
Yeah, we definitely had some dysfunction, especially after the coaching change, because Coach Williams had never had 9 African-American players on one team before. None of us were his recruits.
Right.
So I remember calling us the 9 nasty. And we were a tight-knit group. We all came together to understand what we were doing.
Yeah.
And Coach Williams had problems and trouble with trying to communicate with us because he had never had this before, especially all 5 of our starters were premier players. I think we all were McDonald's All-Americans except for Jackie. We were all very good, and we came up short against Texas our sophomore year, but there was a lot of rifts in between the team because jealousy, you know, the the guys before us felt like it was their show and they needed to shine, and they were considering me, Sean, and Raymond, and Three Musketeers, and stealing the shine away from them. And me, Sean, and Raymond were all leading the ACC in rebounding, assist, and points. Mm. So we were doing exactly what we came to do, but we fell short because we weren't together as a team. And Coach Williams really didn't know what to do. We had to actually have a meeting amongst ourselves our last game in the tournament where we all shaved our heads bald. And we came to the conclusion to squash all the beef and let's just play for each other. We're not going to worry about him and what he says. Let's just go do this thing however we need to. So when we came up short that year, the next year we knew we had a chance. And then Coach Williams took it upon himself to come to me and depend on my leadership to reel in the guys, come in early for the summer, represent for the USA team, me and Sean, and just really take this thing to the next level. And I had a meeting with William Wesley, who was one of my mentors at the time. I could have came out my sophomore year after averaging 20. I could have been top 15. And I told him I didn't want to be another guy playing in the NBA. I wanted to be memorable. I want to be top three. I want to be one of the guys that is not just another NBA player.
Yeah.
And so he said, you got to stay another year and win a championship. And so I ended up still being top 15, but I had a championship. So it still felt a little bit better than just leaving.
Is there a part of you that regrets not coming out after your sophomore year?
Nah, because I have a championship to hold over it. You know, I have adversity to hold over it. I had to overcome a lot. My mom had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. I had an intestinal disorder despite finding that out that set me back 4 games because I had these anxiety. I don't know what it was, but I was just sick to my stomach that my mom could potentially die. Yep. And I didn't know how to digest that at all. And then dealing with the coaching conflict and, you know, I was on Sports Illustrated that year and I had made comments about North Carolina being compared to jail. And it was so much. It was going on that winning the championship was a must. People don't know I'm not new to controversy. Like, I'm not new to anything. Like, I'm battle tested through and through.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So now here's a funny story, and I hope you can relate to this. So when I was at UCLA, Rashad, my senior, so we were getting ready for the tournament, and so they brought in Coach Gene Bartow. Brought in a bunch of great UCLA Bruins from the past. Kenny Washington, who scored 26 and 17 in the championship games in 64 and 65 off the bench. But they brought in this other guy, Walt Hazard, who embraced Islam, and he changed his name to Maudi Abdul Rahman. So we called him Abdul Rahman. And so we had an assistant coach at UCLA, Lee Hunt. Great guy, but kind of one of those good old Southern boys who, for whatever reason, just would not pronounce Rahman, so he started calling him Rocky the whole time that he was on the scout team. And, you know, it just, I'm laughing, but you can imagine how disrespectful. Okay, Rocky, you get over here, Rocky.
Jeez,
I got one better. Hey, Marcus, well,
This is what I'm leading to. This is what I'm leading you to, brother.
I got one better. I'm so glad you said that, because the one that actually leads up to this is Coach Williams. Like I said, he wasn't used to the culture, right? Yeah. So he kept getting my name wrong, Jawad Williams' name wrong, and Rayshon Terry's name wrong. Rayshon, Jawad, and Rashad, right? Uh-huh. So one practice. Now, this should tell you what type of player I was. It wasn't that I wasn't a coach's player. I'm just one of those. I was brought up with a pro black dad.
Right.
So he kept getting our names mixed up, and he said, why can't you guys be named Peter, John, and Billy? And I said, and I raised my hand and I said, Coach, because my name is Rashad and I need you to call me Rashad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he immediately told us to get on the line and run. And wow. He's like, well, thank Rashad for being an athlete. Wow. And that was a consistent thing. His first day he got there, we had a what do you call that? The meal, the pregame meal before the game, where we all there, we all dressed up in our suits, and he's giving his speech, and he's saying we have the dress code, and we don't want anybody showing up with do-rags or holes in their jeans.
Yeah, wow.
There was a bunch of black kids on this team. There may be two white kids, maybe three. And I raised, and he said, I don't want you looking like Snoop Doggy Dog. And I raised my hand and I said, Coach, but Snoop Doggy Dog is a pimp. He wears suits. Everybody turned around and looked at me like, yo, what the f- is wrong with you? And I'm like, I'm like, I don't understand the do-rags and the holes in the jeans and the Snoop Dogg reference when Snoop is a pimp. He don't wear do-rags and he don't got holes in his jeans. Like, I wanted to respect the same respect that you wanted. Like, if you were a coach and you want respect, you got to give respect to the players to get that respect.
Did the dynamic in your guys' relationship cause any issues, or were you in a place mentally where you were trying to be more understanding of what they didn't know about the culture? You know what I'm saying? You know how we sometimes get in that position and we're around a bunch of folks that don't know about what time it is, but then so we kind of stall them out. Or were you in their face like, hold on, man, this is what time this is. This is my name. You know? Okay.
Yeah. No, it was never about being in your face. It was more about them trying to break us.
Yeah.
Like when you're trying to break players and you're trying to get them in line.
Yeah.
And the way that you do that is come across as like a slave master or owner and do this, do that. It's like you're going to create conflict only with the guys who are willing to stand up for themselves. And I was the only one that was willing to say, nah, this ain't right. My dad don't talk to me like this. You're not about to talk to me like this.
Yeah.
So when that happened, it created the you're uncoachable narrative. You're a bad teammate narrative. But I was the one that helped recruit all of the players to get there. They all trusted me. They all trusted my leadership. And it was the coaches that was started with Matt Doherty. He wanted to break me, and he couldn't. And then he passed along the torch to Coach Williams because he used to work for Coach Williams in Kansas. They were best friends. So he told him, I was the issue. You get control of Rashad, you get control of the group.
Mm. Yeah.
So he came in right away trying to control the same narrative, and he couldn't break me as well. So the only narrative that made sense moving forward was that he's uncoachable. But for me, my question to you guys, how can you be a great coach if you can't coach the guy that's uncoachable?
Yeah. It doesn't make sense, right? Because you're supposed to be a really good at what you do. So you're supposed to get through to the guy that it's tough to get through, right, Shot? I mean,
I'm asking. It never made sense.
No, that's how I look at it. Because the job of a coach is to get through those that are not, you can't get through. That's what being a mentor, that's what being someone that is of influence means. You got to use your influence in a positive way to change the direction of this young man's life. So my question is this, do you think that it was a personal thing then, if it wasn't like Coach Williams or Coach Doherty saying, hey, I want to get through to Rashad. So then if they wrote you off, what do you think that was all about?
Well, I mean, to begin with, I thought it was a lot of things that it might not have been. Coach Williams tried to recruit me at Kansas. I said no, because I wanted to go to North Carolina. I think that might have rubbed in the wrong way. Nobody knows Coach Williams is from Asheville, North Carolina. Mm. So we're from, he literally grew up around the corner from where I was born. So that has something to do with a lot of things. And then the North Carolina aspect, just him being able to come to North Carolina after Kansas and be able to make his mark, and for me to be there and not be his recruit because he couldn't get me at Kansas, might have played a part. I think my comments about Carolina being compared to jail was taken out of context by him and the media, because the way the conversation went was just about preparation for the season and skipping out on the NBA and keeping my mental on the progress of the team. And this is kind of like, this is just like, I'm doing my time. Like, I'm in jail, I'm doing my time. And when I get out of here and I go to the next level, you know, we do this. And that could have been something that I shouldn't have said. You know, yeah. I'm not saying that I said the right thing, but it was given, the context was given to me by somebody I trusted, and it made sense to me. Yeah. And so after retracting that statement and making it what it was supposed to be, we all got it under the rug. I think he held that against me. And, you know, these are things that go forth when you talk about perception and psychology. Yeah. You look at, if something is real to someone else, the only way they can find out is if they poke you.
Yeah.
So if we think the Rashad is this type of guy, we won't know until we provoke him into being this guy. And so my whole career was provoking. Everybody was provoking me to be the guy that they heard I was. And yeah. It wasn't until later in my career, later until I was older, to realize that I was just being triggered to be the guy they perceived me to be. So I was proving everybody wrong by being defensive and not really just paying attention to the room and saying, no, I'm not going to let this be the trigger points. I'm not going to let this, you know, show them that they're right. And I had to learn all that on my own.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were one of the first guys that kind of publicly called out, you know, the system. You mentioned it by saying Coach Williams' practices and how you viewed them. And then you dropped I don't know if this was the sequence of events, but you dropped a book, The Plantation Education, The Exploitation of the Modern Day Student Athlete. You were one of the first voices on that, Shad. How much of that do you think contributed to the opportunity you were given in the NBA?
And when did the inspiration to write that book formulate in your mind? Was it while you were at North Carolina, or did you have an epiphany years later that you wanted to expose and peel the curtain back, as you say?
Well, definitely years later, like 2013 is when I really started to digest what I needed to do for the kids. But my whole journey went a certain way based on going against the status quo, going against the system. Yeah. And like I said, I had a pro black dad who did the same thing. And it's not like he taught me these things, but he instilled the courage to do these things and not to worry about anybody being on your side because you don't owe anybody anything. Yeah. So when I wanted to tell my side of the story, going through all the things I went through, being sabotaged by the coaches during draft night. Mm. And finding out in my third year in the NBA that they weren't going to draft me because they got calls saying, don't draft him.
Wow.
Being in draft night, meeting with teams, telling me that other players from my team were telling them that I was doing things that could have contributed to us losing. And basically trying to favor themselves for the draft slot and pushing me out. And I got all this stuff on the fly while still being able to go back and see them smile in my face. So I had to digest all of these things and control all of the resentment that I could have repelled. But when I got into education reform is when I started digging into the NIL or the NLI, which is the National Letter of Intent. Mm-hmm. So I started to dig into the responsibilities of the player and the student going to the university and what that looked like. What's the requirement? Why is it that we can't get paid? So then I started to compare name, image, likeness to a National Letter of Intent and how they all played a part together. And the biggest misconception is the motto for the NCAA, which is free education, no compensation.
Yeah.
So if you're going to get a free education and you're not going to get compensated for playing and making millions and billions of dollars for the NCAA, be thankful for this free education, right? So the thing I had to do was prove that this free education wasn't education at all. You guys are just giving us grades saying that we got a 92% graduation rate while raking in billions of dollars. Mm. And I did that by myself.
But did that register at the time? I mean, just when you're going to these classes, the African American class studies classes that you know, no show classes or paper only class, whatever the situation was, when you were in that, did you have a feeling of being cheated and like shortchanged by it all at that point?
When I first got there, that was the first question I had, and I remember one of the players telling me, "Hey man, just follow the regimen. Don't f*** this up. This is what we do, and this is how it is." Right. You got to remember, I'm 1120 SAT. I'm smart. I can handle the workload. Yeah. I'm cool. But Once it started to look like he got game, once it started to look like blue chips, once it started to look like the program, that's when it's like, damn, so this is how it goes. Okay, so I'm not going to be the one to fuck it up in real time. I'm just going to see how this shit go.
Yeah.
But it definitely was one of those things where it's just a part of the program. It was like, this is how it's done.
Yep.
This is the pipeline.
Yep.
And so after a while, when I started trying to get jobs and try to get hired, and I had an African-American studies supposedly degree or whatever you want to call it, I'm like, well, how far can I take this? Basically, I'm just a social worker.
Yeah.
So for my own people.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to be an engineer, if I wanted to be a doctor, if I wanted to be any of those things, my schedule didn't accommodate that. So any classes I wanted to take, they were like, nah, you're not gonna be able to take that course because it intertwines with practice. You need to take these courses that we give you.
Do you ever envision a day where you reconcile all of this with North Carolina, the coaches, your former teammates? Is there ever going to come a point where you guys would be cool again?
I don't think it's about being cool. We were never cool. It was always a transaction.
Yeah.
You got to think about everything. It was never a family atmosphere. It was, we're here to do a job,
yeah,
and you guys are here to benefit from that job. And so at the end of the day, I never felt like it was a family thing. I felt like I got what I needed, they got what they needed, and we moved on. So I don't think there's a reconciliation, because what can they give me now that I can't give for myself?
Right.
I don't need the applause. I don't need the cheers. I don't need the criticism. I don't need none of that stuff. I'm 40-something years old, and at this point, it's not appealing to me to do anything but right the wrongs. Yeah. Like, let's make sure the kids are taken care of the proper way. Let's get them real education. Let's get them financial literacy. Let's get them the money they deserve, but let's get it to them based on performance-based results. Let's treat them right.
So Rashad, I had an opportunity to interview Ice-T for a book that I've written. I'm trying to be an author too, brother, just like you, but called The Crenshaw Chronicles, about all the great, great luminaries, athletes and non-athletes that went through Crenshaw. One thing he told me, so he's big into, you know, if you know Ice-T's backstory, he says pimpish. He was never really a pimp, but he always kind of admired, like, Iceberg Slim, Pimp the Story of My Life, this book. But he said the one thing that book taught him was not to try and emulate, but to try and understand that if you document the experience through a fictionalized version, that it could have just as much power as you telling that story yourself. Do you have any regrets about peeling back the covers on what happened in North Carolina? Do you wish maybe you'd have put together a nice film for Netflix or somebody about a fictionalized school and everything going on, or do you feel okay with the fact that you were out there, you know, front and center? You put yourself out there. You exposed yourself out there by peeling back the covers on what was going on in North Carolina. Any regrets whatsoever doing it that way?
Why would there be any regrets? If there, the only time you regret something is if you're trying to monetize or you're trying to figure out whether you're going to make money off of it. Like, I'm not the type of dude that would compromise himself for monetary gain. I'm the dude that's going to revolutionize and evolutionize the way people are treated. And the people that I honor and idolize growing up, the Martin Luther Kings, the Malcolm X's, the Tupac Shakur's, the guys who stood in front, 10 toes, like, I come from that. That's what my dad taught me. Regret is the last thing that a coward thinks of. It's the one thing that you, oh man, I wish I would have done this different. Like, no, it wouldn't make me who I am today. Today, I know I'm the best version of me. I know that there are people still right now that can't stand that I'm still here, standing, talking. Yeah. They want to take my voice away. They want to slander. They want to throw things out to make people's perception of me left or right. But for me, the real king is sovereign. We don't have missteps. We don't have regrets. Everything is done because it was written. And we don't worry about what people think about our journey because it's our journey. I've been through the fight. I'm like Freddy Krueger. I've been burnt so many times. You still can't kill me. Like I'm in your dreams, haunting you every single night. Like you cannot run from me.
You're the Undertaker.
No matter what they do, like you can try all you want to, but like I said, some people are intelligent. Some people are ignorant. I'm not worried about the ignorant people who don't understand what the intelligence truly holds. I function on a higher level. I do this for the higher level. If you really go back and research 10 years ago when I cracked this thing open, no, everyone thought I was crazy. Why you say this? Why you do that? Yeah. 10 years later, kids are getting paid to play basketball in college.
Yeah. Big time paid. Big money. Yeah, that's real.
Period.
Yeah.
And they're not doing it the way I asked them to do it because it's in the book where I told them to make it sports and performance-based requirements for these kids so they can't just move around in free agency jumping from team to team. No, you have to perform at your midterm. You should have you have to have improved on all of these levers. Now, this performance is not just classroom-based. Your classroom is being on this team. Your coach is your teacher. You're getting graded to get paid now, but they haven't done that.
Well, no, and I respect that, man. I appreciate you for that. A couple of quick stories, but then we're going to move on to the Milwaukee Bucks real quickly before we let you go. So you keep talking about your father, man, and it's bringing chills inside of me because I had one of those dads. A couple of stories. So one story, we're playing this East Side LA tough inner city school, Jefferson, in a summer league championship. A brawl breaks out, Rashad, fights all over the place, chairs being thrown, but teammates of mine getting busted in the head, 32 stitches. So I'm standing in the middle of all this, my fist up, like, you know, I'm nervous. I'm waiting for somebody to approach me. Nobody approached me. But, you know, it's crazy.
Look at Chris. Not dead.
But nobody ever approached me. And it wasn't until years later, I was sharing this with one of the few, only Korean dude that went to the school who's a baller, Brad Scherer. He was a year older. He was at that game at Trade Tech Junior College. And I was like, man, that crazy fight against Jefferson, Brad, I'm surprised nobody tried to hit me. And what Brad told me, Rashad, was that my father, Jeff, was standing behind me. And every time a Jefferson player would come up, he'd take them and throw them aside. Or he'd grab two of them together. He taught school at a reform school down in Louisiana, down in Shreveport, Louisiana, Bossier City. He'd knock their heads together. And so nobody ever got to me, but it was because my dad was behind me, man. I get almost teary-eyed thinking about that. And then the other quick story is my freshman year, I'm starting at UCLA, averaging 12-7 as a 17-year-old freshman. Bill Walton, Jamal Wilkes, they just won two national championships. But there were a lot of upperclassmen who were a little jealous of the fact that a freshman was getting 8 minutes.
Yeah.
They wanted to get the lead. And so John Wooden, Rashad, calls my father, and this is like toward the end of the season. He tells him, Jeff, look, Marcus has really played well as a starter, but, you know, I think I'm going to have to move him back to the bench, but it's not because of anything that he's done. But I just want to let you know that I'm going to move him back to the bench for the NCAA tournament. So my father told him, it's probably something your dad would say, well, coach, it's your team. You do what you want to do. You're going to lose with your upperclassmen. he told him that flat out. And goes, well, you're probably right, Jeff. But I just, you know, you're probably right, Jeff. So anyway, but I had one of them dads too, and that would just go to battle for you. That was there to support you, you know. And man, people don't understand the black community gets a bad rap sometimes because they always look at us primarily as, you know, single parent homes, and mama was the one that was calling all the shots, but. I just wanted to give a shout out to your dad.
I appreciate that. Let me give you context too, because my dad is still like that right now. He's still very protective. He watches the show every day. He was a big fan of yours, by the way, as well. So it's full circle in that regard. But for right now, like, my dad has always been one. He's been married for 40 plus years. He's been faithful. He's been a great dad over these 42 years now for me. But he was a LeVar Ball type. Like, he never had the platform to be outspoken and go and talk and be there, but he's almost crossed the line and whooped the coach's ass a few times. He's at the game where he had to take himself out of the arena because of what they were doing and saying. And there's a lot of things throughout my career that just drove his, you know, blood pressure up. You know, he's diabetic. He had to have a surgery and he had to have the implant and all of that stuff to survive. So, like, we've been through the ringer as a family, but we're survivors. Like, there's nothing more than being able to tell the story of all the things we've been through. And my dad has always been a pillar of what that looks like. So, you know, all the rumors and all the shit that's going on, we don't pay no attention to none of that, because when you're born in the fire, you're born in the darkness, and then you realize you're the light. You see the people and why they're doing what they're doing, because they can never be where you are. They never go through the things you went through and survive. So all the stuff that you was mentioning, Chris, you about to mention, like, we take that shit up head on head. Like, we're not running from nothing. I wouldn't be here if I was a runner. I would have committed suicide already. I'd have really quit.
Right. And there has been basketball players that have done that, that have checked out and taken, you know, just because of pressure and everything got too much. One last story was Chris's senior year, Steve Lavin. They were talking about Earl Watson, Baron Davis as the starters and bringing Chris off the bench. So I went to practice and Chris was a senior and they were freshmen. And I was like, Lav, what's up with all this conversation about Chris coming off the bench? Well, Coach Wooden says Earl Watson and Baron need to start. That's what Coach Wooden says. I said, well, Coach Wooden also says that you're too inexperienced to be the head coach at UCLA. Are you going to resign? Don't tell me what Coach Wooden say if you're not going to quit right now, because he says that you didn't have the experience to be the head coach. So if you're going to do everything Coach Wooden say, then quit your job or else miss me with all that. Anyway, just want to.
Bars. Hey, that's a real father right there. That's a real father right there.
Chris started that year to average about almost 19, 20 points a game and just had this great, great season and blah, blah, blah. Okay, let's get to the Milwaukee Bucks. I've been doing this thing 12 years with the Bucks, man. Rashad, this is absolutely the most frustrating season that I have ever experienced in my 12 years working with this organization. Now, they won 33 games, Giannis's third year, but that was the year Jason Kidd put him at the point forward, and Giannis had 5 triple-doubles after the All-Star break and really finished. So that was okay. Yeah. But the way this thing is shaking out between the noise and the trades and all the rumors and the noise and the this and the that, and you go 8-2 over a 10-game stretch against teams missing key players and bad teams, and everybody's talking about the corner's been turned. What's your perception of this whole Bucks situation, where it stands now, and where you see it moving forward for the future?
Are you tanking? Are you trying? What are we doing? Right? You get Cam Thomas, a very credible bright spot when you talk about offensive efficiency. But he also pushes Kevin Porter Jr. He also pushes Rollins. He also pushes Kuzma to actually show up more because they are now challenged for positioning. Like, Cam Thomas is a guy that should be playing more than 19 minutes a game. So I would put him in his place based on the fact that we can get a lot more firepower out of him if we play him 28, 29 minutes compared to 19. But when you don't know how to really put these pieces together in a puzzle with Giannis and to give him confidence that the team can go the right direction, the Bucks fans are going to feel a certain way. I think guys like you are going to feel a certain type of way, but you still got to have the team perform at a high capacity. They're not doing that. They look like they're all on their own page at certain times. And when they do play together, they'll have nothing to lose.
Now, so Rashad, I asked a good buddy of mine, best friend, Coach Crenshaw, as a matter of fact, but kind of his perception. He's an avid basketball watcher, NBA follower. He talked about, I said, what do you see with the Bucks? What's wrong with the Bucks? He talked about victimhood, that like opponents can sense victimhood. When they sense like you've got a little doubt within you as a team, it's like a shark smelling blood in the water. And so now, like Bobby Portis touched on it, they circle that as a not a guaranteed win, but a must win. We go into Milwaukee. Oh yeah, we can count this as a, you know. And I don't know. Do you see any of that in terms of your perception of the organization?
When you talk about play hard, play smart together, like that's going to be the number one ingredients for your team as an identity. When you have an identity of this is how we're going to show up, like a OKC, like Indiana Pacers, like a Detroit Pistons, like a San Antonio Spurs, like you got guys that are going to show up and play consistently hard in, night in, night out. That's based on the coach's reiteration of this is our identity. Let's not stray away from who we are. When you got guys out there smelling blood based on you being uncertain, having doubt, looking around like you don't know what's going to go on, you don't know when you're going to come in, you don't know when you're going to come out, it's always secondary on the player. It's philosophy. If you really think about Phil Jackson, he embraced and implemented a philosophy that everyone, like they took a hold of it and they put it inside their games.
Yeah,
that's how you win multiple championships. 3-peat after 3-peat after 3-peat after 3-peat based on a philosophy.
Mm.
We are going to play together, move the ball, and we're going to play defense and we're going to rebound. We're going to play fast when we need to, but we're going to play slow because we're not playing accidental basketball. We're strategizing every single pass, every single counter. If they take this away, we're going to do this as a unit. That takes coaching. That takes patience. That takes accountability from both sides. And I think this year, these generations of players and coaches don't have the patience. They don't have the work ethic. They don't want to execute. They don't want to. They don't want to slow the game down and make the defense play hard on defense. Yeah. They don't want to do any of the things that we grew up knowing was important in the game of basketball.
You say accidental basketball. Does that equate to your mind? Because this is a term that came out with the Bucks and other teams over the last 5 or 6 years. Randomness. We're going to play random. I mean, are you a fan of randomness, or do you feel like it should all be? It could be spontaneous as a basketball player, but you still have to play with under the umbrella of a certain system that you've implemented and a mindset that you've implemented. Do you believe in randomness as a player?
I like talking to y'all because y'all are hoopers and y'all know hoops, so we're going to talk hoop. So in pickup, 5-on-5 pickup during the summertime, that's random basketball.
Yeah.
Right? But if you're a real hooper, you feel uncomfortable playing random basketball because this is not how you're going to play in the upcoming season. Facts. I'm not going to be out here running and just catching the ball and doing this is not how our sets are going to go. So I'm going to do minimum of this freelance as possible and try to work inside of the game that I know out here while I play. Let's talk about fast break. You play defense well enough to get a fast break where you don't have to run the offense. Now we get to play random.
Right.
This is what we would call freelance, right? So now if you're a real hooper like Chris was, where we can get the ball in transition, it comes down, we're not going to go right in the secondary break. We're just going to get the ball and go drive and kick.
Yeah, yeah.
We called it three-man game. Right. Drive, kick. We're not in secondary break. We just got it off the rebound. Let's just make something happen.
Right.
But for that to be your primary offense, come down, pick and roll at the top. Let's drag it, swing it into a pick and roll again, swing it into a pick and roll again. No execution, no counters, no nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
20 straight possessions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and to your point, I mean, I would even say that even freelance with good teams like the Spurs and you know the Manu Ginobili, Tony, even their freelance, it was structured.
Yes, rules. Yes.
If I dribble, you going back door. If you know if I can back pick you a big small, I'm a back pick. I'm a pop. You know, yep. I mean, there was still some basic rules. Kind of structure yeah. even in the freelance. There were rules. That you
yes.
had to follow,
and yes.
you know what I mean, like a jazz improvisational jazz player. There's a certain limit of
UCLA cuts. The yeah. UCLA yeah. cuts,
exactly.
Right,
exactly.
But yeah. I would say that we know this as just hoopers,
right?
Even if we're playing pickup, and Chris is coming down, he's like, hey, let's just do this UCLA cut real quick. Right. I know to get to the side. The big nose to come up to the elbow. We right. know now we're running this thing, and Chris gets to dictate what he does when he gives it up.
He can push me through. I can run the baseline. You and Marcus, y'all go pick and roll on the side. We're going to play the weak side. See what y'all got? We're going to run. We just know this stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Because we played and we studied the game. Yeah. We're talking about being students.
Right.
Not just guys who go and play. We study. We had to know your playbook. You had to know every position in the playbook. So if you got caught in the four-man position, you knew what to do. You might let Marcus bring it down. He's going to play point. He's got point a forward. Mismatch.
Point forward. That's me.
Man, he's going. We going to let him do his thing.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
But you can't. You can't. To play up and not know where he, you got to play his position now. You got point guard, you got to play the power forward because Marcus got your position now. Let's not mess this up.
Well, look, we're going to let you go, man. No, this has been really good, man. And I appreciate you being candid with us, speaking from your heart, like you always do. I mean, I knew you would do that. And I'd forgotten the controversy of the book and everything in North Carolina until I started doing the research. And it just gave me even a higher level of respect for you for having that courage, the word, to stand out on the front line, expose what needed to be exposed, but then willing to take the smoke, as they say, that comes with it. And hey, so man, not this whole conversation about you ducking smoke.
Come on, I was a whistleblower. I was a whistleblower and a snitch before I was a quitter. So you gotta put it. You gotta make it all make sense. Which one is it, right?
Yeah.
I went up against the NCAA in North Carolina for 10 years.
Woo.
Like, you think? Like, what do you mean? Scared of somebody who I dominated? I can't be.
What's the Darren Williams situation? Did you guys, we were on the same team at some point? Was there something?
No, man. Me and him are competitors. We had a conversation. We squashed all of the misunderstandings. Okay. Nobody knows all of that, but D was always one of my guys, man. We played in the summer. We played against each other throughout our careers. He was always one of my guys. Like, we actually spent time in the summer together. So I think he got pulled into something that wasn't really something that he wanted to contribute to. And I always consider him to be a top-notch, top-tier, a top-tier, top-level guy, player. Like, he was always one of my guys.
Okay.
And there's no beef there. There's nothing going on there. We had a conversation. I can't say the same for the rest of the guys because I don't know what they beef with me is. I think they protecting the plantation. And so when you protecting the plantation, like, nobody else from the team is saying anything except for Raymond. And I don't know where Charlie comes from. I don't know what his energy is, but his brother used to reach out to me and try to get me and Charlie to do some stuff before.
Right.
So I guess it's for views. I don't understand why I get thrown in the mix for it.
Right.
But when it comes to integrity and answering questions, I don't have to. Like, my track record of being a leader, leading a national championship team, you can't be a quitter if you're the leader of the army who always wins.
No, you've had a hell of a journey, brother. You've had a hell of a journey. Thank you for coming by here, District, and sharing it with us. Gives us a complete perspective of who Rashad McCants is.
I appreciate you both, man. And I really, really do respect not only your family, but the individual journey of both of you guys. I still think love and basketball was about y'all, so I ain't gonna tell nobody. But yeah, man, I really respect y'all, man, and I appreciate you having me.
They know. All right, man. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks, y'all.